An increase in COVID-19 cases is felt in South Florida as we enter what some call a pandemic of the unvaccinated. Plus, what comes next for the town of Surfside now that the rubble from the condo collapse has mostly been cleared? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm Katie Spitalski-Munoz in for Tom Hudson. This week, South Florida hospitals are seeing more COVID patients, and the majority of them have not gotten their shots. We navigate through the latest. Have you changed the way you're going about your life now that cases are ticking up? Are you concerned or not concerned about the Delta variant? Call us at 800-743-9576 or tweet us at WLRN. And Saturday marks 1 month since the Champlain Towers South condo building collapsed in Surfside. We look to a panel of reporters who have been on the ground. Made possible by Willie the B-Man, Bee Removal Specialist. I'm Katie Spitalski-Munoz, filling in for Tom Hudson. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. In the past 2 weeks, hospitals around the state have seen the number of people coming in positive for COVID-19 go up. At South Florida hospitals, COVID-positive patients are up by more than 100%. That's at both Jackson Health and Memorial Healthcare System. More than 90% of those patients ending up in hospitals with the virus are unvaccinated. But we're still seeing instances of breakthrough cases in vaccinated people. All in all, as the Delta variant spreads, Florida is one of three states that contributed to 40% of all new cases in the U.S. this week, according to the White House. What's next? Where do we evaluate our risk in South Florida? How can vaccinated people prepare for the Delta variant without panicking? How do health experts convince more unvaccinated people to go get shots? Are you concerned? Not concerned? You can share your thoughts about the spike in COVID-19 cases by calling us and letting us know at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also share your thoughts with us on Twitter, too, at WLRN. Joining us now are Aurelio Fernandez, the president and CEO of Memorial Healthcare System, and Dr. Haney Atala, chief medical officer of Jackson Memorial Hospital. Aurelio, we're going to start with you. When did Memorial Healthcare System begin seeing this rise in hospitalizations?
Really in the month of July. Up until June, our numbers were in a decline. And since mid-June, really in the last 4 weeks, we have seen an increase of 240% to the highest census today that we've had in many, many months. So it is really concerning at the pace that we're seeing the increase. And by the way, this is not unique to Memorial Healthcare. I'm sure Dr. Atala will say the same thing for Jackson. This is throughout the state. We had the president of the Florida Hospital Association in our facility today, and she was sharing with us the concerns that all the hospitals in the state of Florida have regarding the rapid rise in the number of COVID admissions to our hospitals.
Is it related to the 4th of July?
I think it's the, and I'll let Dr. Atala answer, but we believe that the Delta variant is much more infectious than the prior. Think about it. We have a significant number of the population already vaccinated, and we are adhering more to the CDC guidelines than we did back in last summer. So I do believe is that the level of infection that this Delta virus has in comparison to the prior one. But people got loose after the 4th of July. There was a lot of partying going on. It usually takes 10 to 14 days after a big event to start seeing the volumes increase, but it could definitely be a contributing factor to the rise in COVID admissions to our hospital.
And I just wonder if you can describe for us the big picture of what this increase in cases week over week is really looking like. How many COVID patients does Memorial currently have, and how are their conditions?
Sure. Okay, today our total census was almost 1,300 patients, of which 23% were COVID positive, which is 295. And out of the 295, we had 47 patients in our critical care areas. The age group is different than it was back in the summer of 2020. Just to give you an example, in July Latter part of July of 2020, we had a high of 672 positive COVID patients in our facilities. And today we're at 295. But it's not that it's almost half. The concern is the rapid and the exponential growth that we're experiencing. I can't recall last summer going up. Yesterday we were 271. In one day, we increased it by 24 patients. And everyone else is seeing numbers they have not seen since last summer.
Well, I'm just curious too. I mean, are they in critical condition? Are they healing well? Do they need lung transplants?
No. I think what you're seeing is, there are patients in ventilators. As usually runs, a percentage of our patients are on ventilators, but we use something called high flow. There's more use of high flow today than it was back in the summer of 2020. They're younger. The number of ICU patients to the population is less than it was in the summer of last year. Don't forget, last year we were dealing with a large number of nursing home patients, 65 and older, more comorbid. And again, I go back to the fact that last year at this time, we did not have a vaccine. So they're younger. They're not going to the ICU as much as they were before. 12% of our patients who present in our emergency room with COVID are able to go home and quarantine themselves. So it's 88% of those who present do get admitted. So that is what we're seeing, at least in our facilities. And we have six hospitals in our network, in our healthcare system. Our pediatric utilization is very low. I think we had three as today out of the 295. So it's more in the age group between 30 and 50 that are causing the jump.
Before I get to you, Dr. Atala, I did just want to ask you, Aurelio, to get a sense of what have the discussions been like with other hospitals at the state level recently, because we do know that Florida, along with Texas and Missouri all together, those three states accounted for 40% of all the cases in the country this week.
Yeah. Well, Katie, I'm glad you asked that, because here in South Florida, all the CEOs in Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach meet every Wednesday at 4 o'clock to discuss our census, what is going on, visiting hours, policy, what are we doing about vaccination and percentage of vaccination. So from a local market, all the CEOs and chief medical officers have weekly calls that address the issues that are going on in particular hospitals. Now, having had the president of the Florida Hospital Association in our facility today, that same type of communication is going throughout the state so that we can share what are some of the challenges that we have. I can tell you the biggest challenge is staffing, especially in nursing. We have seen a significant recruitment effort by what we call traveling nurses in our market that have gone elsewhere to work, whether it be California, Texas, where else in the United States, except for South Florida. And that is concerning, because you cannot just get a graduate nurse and put it on the field. It takes months to onboard a nurse to become safe and articulate enough to know what they're doing. So it's not something that you can hire somebody from the street. So it is concerning. But hospitals are communicating. The Florida Hospital Association and the Safety Net Hospital Alliance are taking the lead in opening communications and providing suggestions both to the governor's office and to the Agency for Healthcare Administration.
And you alluded to this earlier, but at a press conference this week, Jackson Health Systems President Carlos Magoya said about 58% of Jackson's staff are vaccinated. And let's hear from him. He says he wants more employees to get a shot.
And that's another plea to make sure that we get all the public safety people out in the community to get vaccinated as well. It's extremely important we get all the young, strong people to get vaccinated, equally as important as the older people with comorbidities.
And Dr. Haney Atala, I want to bring you into this conversation. What reasons are you hearing among frontline healthcare workers that they don't want to get vaccinated?
Excuse me. You know, we have people have sort of a number of reasons why they have this vaccine hesitancy, you know, whether it's because it's not fully FDA approved or any number of reasons. You know, we've had several sessions trying to educate people on the safety of the vaccine. Ultimately, the vaccine is safer to get than it is to get COVID. We really try and address their concerns and answer their questions to try and convince them. The hesitancy is a bit all over the map. And so that's, but we're just really trying to get back to people and say, listen, it's safe, it's effective. We can show you the evidence. What questions do you have? How can we help alleviate some of your concerns around the vaccine?
And how can Jackson Health System encourage more of its employees to get vaccinated? And I guess also the flip side of that, what are the consequences if it can't?
I mean, you heard it from Mr. Magoya, really sort of encouraging people to get the vaccine. I think, the way to do this, whether it's within a hospital system or within the community, is to just say, let's take a good objective look at the evidence. Let's take a look right now at who is in a hospital with COVID infection. And I don't know if Mr. Fernandez is seeing something similar, but most of the patients who are being admitted to the hospital are unvaccinated people, right? And the people who are vaccinated who get a breakthrough infection who are being admitted have much more mild disease than they probably otherwise would have had. So, it was said earlier on something I was listening to that this is a pandemic of the unvaccinated. What questions can we answer for you? How can we alleviate some of your concerns? Ultimately, at the end of the day, it's the person's choice. But at the same time, what we owe our staff and what we owe the community is to try and tell them, this is the reality around the vaccine, and this is the reality around not getting the vaccine. And they have to ultimately make their own decision.
And Aurelio, at Memorial, you are also seeing about the same level of employee vaccination as Jackson. Is that right?
Yeah, Carlos and I are in constant communications. You're gonna find that the medical staff has a higher percentage of vaccinated providers than the rest of the staff, but ours is a little lower. Ours is between 56 and 57% of the total workforce that has been vaccinated. But I can tell you that what we have experienced this week with the upside of number of positive admissions, we have seen more and more employees getting vaccinated because now they're taking it seriously.
Well, that's great. Well, on the phone, we've got Michael in Boynton Beach. Michael, you're on the South Florida Roundup.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I was just kind of curious your opinions about people that have already had COVID. I myself had it about 6 months ago. Fortunately, I wasn't very sick. I only had symptoms for a couple of days. And I've continuously checked my antibody response, which has remained strong. I'm not anti-vax, but I would prefer that it was obviously FDA approved before I go and get it. All of this talk of people that are going to hospitals now that are unvaccinated and getting COVID, is there any discussion to be had about people that develop natural immunity, knowing that the mRNA vaccines actually create antibodies similar to the ones that I guess you would get from natural immunity to COVID? And why is there not a larger discussion about that?
Dr. Atala, do you want to take that one?
Sure. So I think it's a really good question. And it's one of the things we've heard from other people is, well, I already have it, so I should be immune. So for a period of time, that's true. But what we've also seen is people who have had COVID, that immunity tends to wane more than the immunity tends to wane with a vaccine. So for a period of time, and that period of time is sort of a little bit nebulous, it just depends on your own immune system and when you had the infection and how bad the infection was and all those kinds of things, you'll have some immunity for a while, but that immunity will wane. And we've certainly seen people who have had COVID more than once. In that population, it's a good question, but the recommendation, and I think it makes sense, is still to go get the vaccine because then you won't necessarily see that immunity wane as it would if it was just natural infection.
And we've got another question from Seth in West Palm Beach. Seth, you're on the South Florida Roundup. Oh, it looks like we lost Seth. Sorry about that. Well, as I understand, Aurelio, PPE supplies, are they a concern at this point? And are you equipped to handle, as a hospital, this higher COVID caseload we're seeing?
Yeah, absolutely. The whole industry has really addressed the issues of PPEs. I would venture to say that every hospital in South Florida has adequate PPE coverage. We have adequate ventilators. We have all the different medications, remdesivir, you name it, we have it. the challenge that we all face, and it's the same challenge throughout, definitely South Florida, is staffing on the nursing side. But PPEs, we have more than adequate supply.
When I understand, you know, while the Florida Department of Emergency Management had been helping with vaccination efforts, now the agency has handed pandemic operations back to the Florida Department of Health and local sites. That was at the end of June. What, you know, where are you coordinating as a hospital leader if you need direction from the state, if you need to put in requests for things like supplies? Are you getting what you need?
The Agency for Healthcare Administration has been extremely accommodating. I have to give kudos to the governor's office, especially during last pandemic, where they provided us with PPEs, beds, ventilators, you name it. They were a huge resource, and they're still there as a resource. But what we have found is that the providers, the hospital industry, has addressed that issue by elevating their inventory levels to be able to handle an upsurge like we're experiencing now. But we had the director, the secretary of the Agency for Healthcare Administration 2 weeks ago visit South Florida, and she is 100% committed to provide us with whatever support is necessary to address this surge in number of COVID patients to our hospitals.
I'm Katie Switalski-Munoz. You're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN, and we're speaking with the president and CEO of Memorial Healthcare System, Aurelio Fernandez, and the chief medical officer of Jackson Health System, Dr. Haney Atala, about the impacts of the latest surge in COVID cases and what that effect is having on their hospitals. What are your thoughts about the uptick in coronavirus cases in our state? Share them with us by calling 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. Or you can tweet us at WLRN. I want to bring you in, Dr. Atala. We know that breakthrough infections are going to happen with any vaccine. And breakthrough cases of COVID-19 in fully vaccinated people, does that mean the shot has failed? Why is it important to get the vaccine even if you could still end up getting COVID?
You know, the vaccine, so there have been breakthrough infections. It still gives you some more immunity. So the people who may have a breakthrough infection, we don't expect them and haven't seen them get as sick as they may have if they hadn't had the vaccine. So although it's not 100% effective, it is very effective. And if it, for some reason, is ineffective, meaning you get a breakthrough infection, it still helps reduce the severity of illness. So that may mean the difference between, you know, the high flow O2 that's being used versus a ventilator. And it may be the difference between going home in 7 days versus being in the hospital after coming out of the ICU for a month. So we can't measure necessarily that benefit, but we have seen it in patients who have been vaccinated, who have breakthrough infection, the severity of their illness tends to be much less.
When it looks like we did get Seth back from West Palm Beach, and if he's on the line with us, I'd love for him to be able to ask his question.
Yeah, hi, are you there?
Hi, Seth, you're on the South Florida Roundup.
Yeah, hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm partners in a company called Dr. House Calls. We're a mobile physician group that sees patients in South Florida, assisted living, independent living, private homes, and we do the PCR and the vaccines in the home. And the biggest thing I need to emphasize is that 99.7% of the people that are being hospitalized and dying are unvaccinated. And the people that have breakthroughs are usually very mild and not going to the hospital, and most importantly, not dying. So we see this in our patients that are vaccinated and the patients that have not been vaccinated. So how do we get this word out when there are so many people, whether it's from a political situation or what, how do we get them to educate people that are refusing to get a vaccine? And the problem not getting a vaccine is not only your own health, but if you're a person with a child under 12 years old, you can get them infected because right now they can't get a vaccine, and it's not right.
Thank you, Seth. Dr. Atala, you know, are you seeing any ways that we can sort of, do we need to be changing our messaging for people who are unvaccinated, or is it a question about access?
I mean, I think Seth hit the nail right on the head. You know, how do we go out in the community? You know, it may be interesting just to ask people who are hesitant about the vaccine, what would it take? You know, what would it take? Would it take, you know, more evidence? Would it take I mean, I hate to say it, but would it take someone close to you getting very, very ill for you to change your mind? You know, I was listening to a show the other day, and this woman was kind of coming out of the hospital. She had not been vaccinated, and she was just being discharged from the hospital after what sounded like a fairly severe infection. She said, as soon as I'm well, the first thing I'm going to do is go get my vaccine shot. So, you know, education, evidence, and then specifically looking at people and what their hesitancy is, and then trying to address it and explain it to them, you know, I mean, that's sort of off the top of my head where I would start. But you know, agree with Seth completely. It is an absolute must for people to get their vaccine if we're all going to get through this.
And thinking about where we are in South Florida with Spanish language radio stations often containing some misinformation about the vaccine, or a lot of myths on the internet and social media about the vaccine, is mis and disinformation a big hurdle for our region that we can get past?
Yeah, I mean, this mis and disinformation is a hurdle. You know, what source you trust to get your evidence, I think it's all over the place. You can always find something that's going to support whatever view you're taking. But if we're going to look, I mean, you know, the Centers for Disease Control, for example, in this country are, you know, we consider that an authority, right? So what is that, you know, authority saying? You know, major universities, you know, often have good evidence as well. So, you know, looking, you know, I would venture to guess that some of the social media sites that are more open to putting things out there that people's opinions rather than facts are maybe not the best place to go to get good data on this. So where people get their information, I think, is key to hopefully helping alleviate some of their concerns.
And Sue in Fort Lauderdale wants to share her thoughts. Sue, welcome to the South Florida Roundup.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just want to ask whoever, when you're talking about vaccine hesitancy, is there not an opportunity to restrict the ease of movement for unvaccinated people? I feel, as a fully vaccinated person, that I've done my job to help the community at large, and we isolated, we quarantined, we did it all. And now here we are almost on our way to being normal, and now we have this major setback, and it's actually restrictive for the fully vaccinated people as well. So while maybe not allowing an unvaccinated person on a flight or in a bar seems like an infringement on their rights, isn't it an infringement on our rights to have restaurants close and international countries not allow us in, et cetera?
Thank you for sharing that, Sue. Aurelio, I'm going to pose that to you because I want to ask you, with this surge in cases too, you know, thinking about Sue's thoughts, what types of actions is Memorial taking now that there is an increase in cases when it comes to unvaccinated or visitors?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, Sue. And I can tell you from a visitor perspective, we do require vaccines if you're going to visit your loved ones. We cannot afford as an industry to have our workforce, especially our clinicians, to be to acquire the virus, because being in the front lines, we need to have adequate staffing to take care of those who are patients in our facilities. So we monitor that very, very closely. We're already in a level of stage of red, which is serious. We do not allow someone to accompany a person in the emergency department, only those if they're expecting mothers, we allow one visitor. And again, they have to show proof of vaccination. They have to wear a mask. It is an issue in the private sector, whether you're talking restaurants or in other leisure industries, and how do they handle it. But here at the hospital, all the hospitals have to take a very careful approach as to who is allowed in the hospital to prevent the virus from spreading.
And I just want to read, we got a note from Rosanna on Twitter. As a South Florida nurse, I am beyond exhausted. Even nurses not working directly with COVID patients are at a breaking point. 50% of our staff left to work COVID jobs, and I've been working 70 to 90. And I believe she means 70 to 90 hours. I do want to ask, you know, how long can we see this surge continue, Aurelio, and what kind of resources will you need if this surge continues for the next several months, or if this becomes a trend?
Yeah, this is a serious situation. I said from the outset that staffing is the major issue. Everyone is tired. How long can you stand a 12-hour shift fully protected in front of a patient that could give you a virus and subject you to a potential infection of the virus? So we're very sensitive to it. Our heroes, which they're all heroes, you got to give them a lot of credit. And I believe that the public out there do not have an appreciation of what a nurse, a physician, a respiratory therapist has to go through. And not even them, anyone who works in the hospital in the front lines, what they have to go through to care for them. And I think it's selfish for someone who's not vaccinated, and then they present themselves in the ER, and then they have to be taken care of. So no, they're called heroes for a reason. And you gotta see him working fully decked out. And it's a very challenging job. You cannot just produce a nurse or a physician overnight. It takes time to onboard the individuals, but it is a very concerning situation when it comes to staffing to all of us as health caregivers.
And Dr. Atala, one final question for you before we have to go to break. People that have had breakthrough infections, fully vaccinated people who are testing positive, are they still infectious to other people? Do we know if they can pass that on?
They can, certainly. And I mean, Mr. Fernandez was talking a little bit about the Delta variant earlier. We've seen some higher viral loads, meaning that people can be more infectious with the Delta variant, which is obviously a concerning trend. You know, if you test positive, whether you're vaccinated or not, you're still contagious. And so, you know, making sure we take the proper precautions, you know, is important. You know, I do want to add one thing. The question that came across the radio about our rights and things, you know, I'm vaccinated. And when I get in the elevator in the building I'm staying in, you know, I put my mask on. You know, do I enjoy it? No, I don't necessarily enjoy it. But is it the right thing to do? You know, it is. And I think we all just have to keep trying to do our part as much as we can do to get through this.
I've been speaking with Dr. Haney Atala, the Chief Medical Officer of Jackson Memorial Hospital, and Aurelio Fernandez, the President and CEO of Memorial Healthcare System. Thank you both for your time.
Thank you.
Still to come, now that the rubble is nearly cleared, we'll be talking about the Surfside condo collapse when it comes to what lies ahead for the town and the people who have been impacted. You can join that conversation by calling us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. Spitalski Munoz, in for Tom Hudson. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. It's been 4 weeks since the Champlain Towers South condominium in Surfside partially collapsed in the middle of the night. Miami-Dade County officials have said nearly 100 people have lost their lives. Many more have been displaced. The site where Champlain Towers South once stood is almost completely cleared, but the community is still reeling from a tragedy nearly 1 month later. First responders are now heading home after a month of grueling and emotional work. What's next? How does this community move forward? What have we learned in the weeks since this collapse? And how will condominium culture in South Florida change? You can share your thoughts about the recent events in Surfside and the response by calling us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. And you can share with us on Twitter, too. We're at WLRN. Joining us now are a panel of reporters who have been following the Champlain Tower South story from the ground. We've got Veronica Zaragovia, our healthcare reporter for WLRN, Wendy Rhodes, senior politics and economy reporter for the Palm Beach Post. She covered Surfside on an assignment for USA Today. And Joey Fletches, reporter for the Miami Herald. Thank you all for taking the time to join the South Florida Roundup today.
Thank you for having us.
Joey, let's start with you. You were one of the first reporters on the scene when the Champlain Tower South condo collapsed. How have you seen your reporting change through this search and rescue and then recovery processes?
Well, the first day was really about getting your head around something unimaginable and incomprehensible, right? A building just falling. I remember so many experts and people, just regular people that I talked to while going to the scene, people on social media, people everywhere, just really saying, looking at each other and saying, like, how can a building just fall? And that's still a question that remains to be answered, but the reporting evolved to answering, you know, the very human questions of who was in there and did they make it out? And if not, you know, then they became a search and rescue. It was a search and recovery. It was about memorializing the people who lost their lives. It was about telling their story so that people wouldn't forget about the human toll. It grew. And it really, the story became about a community coming together to mourn the loss of a very large part of that community. We've written stories about how everybody knew somebody or knew someone who knew someone who lived in Champlain Tower South. And so it's grown into a story that really captures, you know, the magnitude of this tragedy.
And what details from your reporting and your stories have stayed with you over the past month?
I can't stop thinking really about the visualization that I had and that I made in my mind when I was interviewing people hours after the building fell, people who had survived and had made their way down from their units via the stairs, or they had been saved by the firefighters on scene early that morning, and them describing what they saw when they opened their front doors, when they stepped out into the hallways that showed them that a portion of their building was gone, and it was just dust and darkness and the beach and the sky, and that those details about Alfredo Lopez going down into the basement and picking up a woman who was frozen in shock and carrying her out from the cracks of the garage, or people waiting on their balconies waving down firefighters trying to get safely be lowered down, and the feelings that they felt that day as the sun came up and as people could see, you know, the details of the bunk beds, the egg chair that a neighbor told me he used to see a woman sit on to watch the sunset. Those are the details of everyday life that are now different and gone that have stayed with me.
And Wendy, I want to bring you into this conversation. You work in Palm Beach County, and you were in Surfside every day until yesterday. That's a long commute, and I understand you stayed in Surfside the entire time you've been reporting. How soon after the collapse did you arrive, and what were those initial days for you like?
I arrived in Surfside the morning after the collapse. We read about it, obviously. We heard about it. And I kind of jumped in my car and ran down there with like nothing but my purse and ended up staying until yesterday. And I mean, it was those initial days. I mean, I think Joey really hit the nail on the head. I mean, they were a combination of just chaos and heartbreak. I mean, obviously there was, you know, first responders and families and, you know, neighbors and everybody trying to figure out what was going on. And you couldn't get from point A to point B because the roads were closed and half of the places were closed to even foot traffic. So it was hard to get around, and it was hard to get in touch with officials, to get information, to disseminate to the public, you know. And a lot of those first days was just making sure that we were reporting correct, factual, accurate information as well as we knew it at the time. Because there was a lot of, you know, rumors and myths and hearsay. So a lot of it for me was working with authorities and just making sure that our facts were straight.
And Veronica, you have reported this story for WLRN with personal connections to the area. You grew up near Surfside with ties to the community. How do you think national media outlets have been covering this tragedy and its aftermath?
Well, I have nothing but respect for all of our colleagues who've been working so hard to cover this. It's just that for people who don't live here, it's like, oh, this Florida town they're swooping into, and wow, this building collapsed, and for those of us who grew up there or around there, we really understand what Surfside is about, and why people were there from different countries, or maybe why people had been renting it out. We just kind of really understand the dynamics of South Florida and of Surfside particularly, and we're not just coming in and out, we're there for the long term.
And I wonder too, you know, what do you think the media could have done better?
I think the one difficulty I've run up against is that people feel really tired of certain questions that might trigger them to cry in certain instances. And so they've either like said, no, I don't want to talk to the media, or they've said, what are you going to ask me now? How do I feel? And so it's not finger pointing, because I certainly have made mistakes of my own. I just think that maybe we can come at it as like, tell me about this person that you loved, as opposed to how did you feel when you found out, so that they get emotional on camera or on radio or whatever, or print. And so, and also just really, giving maybe there are other ways to tell the story without all of us camping out right there. This is happening in real time, and I'm trying to understand what we could do so that we're not just overdoing it and still having access to survivors and the families of victims.
As journalists, we got to grade ourselves sometimes, right?
That's right.
Well, State Senator Jason Pizzo and some state leaders, including Governor Ron DeSantis, have made comments about the media coverage of Surfside, saying that the government will continue to be there for victims long after the cameras leave. And I just wanted to sort of see where you think the value of local media coverage moving forward is.
Yeah, that I think has been unfair, because I've heard in the case of Senator Pizzo or other elected officials to like kind of boast about intimate moments that they witnessed that you won't see this on the cameras, or this didn't make it on the media. And it's like, well, we have not been granted access to the rubble. And so I guarantee you that if we had, that WLRN, of course, would be recording tape of very intimate moments. We just don't have that kind of access, but we've been working. I've worked 15, 20 hours for most of the last month, or day, sorry. And I think that that probably is the same for our colleagues at local papers and TV stations. And so we're doing what we can. And I think the value of local media is that when someone says to me at a restaurant in Harding, we're closing for Shabbat, I know what that is, that, you know, they're closing for the Sabbath. I understand the dynamics of the Jewish community. I understand when someone is Cuban, or versus I've met a woman who worked at a spa and she's Colombian, and she was, I just understand what kind of connections people have to that area. And I think we have done, and we will continue, all of us, to do it justice and do some great reporting moving forward.
Well, I'm Katie Switalski-Munoz. Tom Hudson is off this week. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. We're speaking with local reporters about their experiences covering the Surfside condo collapse over the last 4 weeks. What have you been thinking and feeling about Surfside? What are your Surfside connections? What stories or information has touched you over the past month? What questions would you still like to be answered? Call us now at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. Or you can tweet us at WLRN. We're going to be right back with more of this discussion after the break. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Katie Switalski-Munoz, in for Tom Hudson. It's been a month since the Champlain Tower South condo building collapsed. The site is nearly cleared, and the future of the site is still uncertain. Some believe a memorial should be placed at the site, and some think a new condo building should be built. Surfside Commissioner Eliana Salzhauer is opposed to rebuilding.
First of all, who's going to want to live there? I mean, you couldn't pay me to live there. Who wants to live there? I mean, it's hard enough to live next door to that.
What do you think should be placed at the site? What thoughts or questions do you have about the response to the Surfside condo collapse? Share those with us by calling 800-743-9576. We're still joined by our local journalists who have been covering the Surfside story very closely throughout the past month. I'm going to bring back in Wendy Rhodes with the Palm Beach Post. She covered Surfside on assignment for USA Today. Wendy, you've reported that the foundation at the site of the collapsed building possibly holds an answer to why the building fell. What are you hearing from experts about what comes next in the investigation?
So the structural engineer that was hired to investigate the reason of the collapse of the South Tower, he was hired by the town of Surfside to do that, has told me that he's open to a lot of things that might have contributed to this, and that it's probably not just one thing, it's probably a combination of things. But he did tell me that one of the things he really wants to look at is the foundation of this building. The reason being because, you know, there was three Champlain Towers, right? North, south, and east. So east was built at a different time and doesn't really resemble the north and south towers. But you have the South Tower, which collapsed, and then the North Tower, which is three lots north, which underwent voluntary evacuations. And what he wants to do is compare some of the samples, like do some testing and comparing in, you know, the concrete, the footing, columns, things like that, in the two buildings to see why did one fall and why didn't. They were both built by the same developer. They both shared the same architect, and they were both built around the same time, but they had different structural engineers. And the reason that's important is because structural engineering, that's the fundamental basis of how a building responds under pressure, under weight, under environmental impacts. So the foundation of the building in the south building that collapsed may be different than the foundation of the building in the north building that didn't collapse. Each blueprint called for two different things. What they actually used is a different story. So that's one of the things that they want to look into that may hold the key or part of the keys to why the South Building fell and the North Building didn't.
And we've talked about how long the investigations, plural, might take at different levels. What have you been hearing in your reporting when it comes to the progress of investigations and what exactly it will take for engineering experts to determine what went wrong here?
Well, I can assure you that that the Surfside engineer has been doing extensive testing on the north building, the one that didn't fall, collecting and analyzing data, using ground penetrating radar that is like a way to see into concrete and see the integrity of the steel, the reinforced steel or the rebar inside it, taking calcium chloride samples on concrete to see about any potential saltwater intrusion, checking to see if any of the reinforcing steel or rebar had bloomed or corroded, which is what makes it kind of crumble. But he has not been able to have access to the South Tower, the one that fell, because the day that it fell, police declared that a crime scene. So he's collecting all of his information from the North Building to compare to the South Building, but hasn't had access. Now, we've asked that question repeatedly, you know, when will he get access? When will other experts get access to the debris from the South Tower to be able to even start that work? And we haven't gotten a straight answer on that. So we anticipate it'll come fairly soon because the area is cleared out. But until they can start, it's kind of difficult to determine when it's going to end.
And Joey Fletches from the Miami Herald, now that the rubble is mostly cleared, what comes next in your reporting process?
Well, my primary responsibility at the Herald is covering Miami City Hall and the intersection between government policy, both at the local municipal level and at the state level, and the processes that preceded this collapse, the standards, the inspection processes, the recertification process, all of that is under scrutiny, and it's under scrutiny by a number of groups. And it's certainly a major part of our reporting process going forward in understanding what does each municipality in Miami-Dade County, which each government that has jurisdiction over, making sure that buildings are safe, the Unsafe Structures Board, building officials, inspectors, what are the qualities that they're looking for in inspectors? What are the minimum standards for people who are eligible to do this work and for the reports that they submit to the city, if they're even required to resubmit to the city? Those are all in different ways being evaluated by different communities in Miami-Dade County. We're tracking all of those. And certainly, you know, this following Surfside, there was a wave of inspections that led to a lot of questions for a lot of condo owners and tenants who have different levels of access to information about their buildings, right? There were a lot of inspections, and that yields a whole lot of, you know, procedural and governmental questions that we would like to answer. And we certainly would like to see where changes might occur in state law and in local law. There are panels at the state level, panels of engineers and panels of the Florida Bar has a panel that is analyzing what exists in the statute and going to make recommendations probably before the next legislative session to basically prevent this from happening again. That is ultimately the goal, right? To understand what happened and to make sure it doesn't happen again.
We've got a caller, Lynx in Miami Beach. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup, Lynx.
Thank you for having me today. One of the things that I just always struck me was the amount of development that is taking place in Miami. And this, I have no scientific anything to back this up, but it was just always something that I just was wondering with the disruption to the earth, especially in Surfside and in Miami Beach and Sunny Isles, where you're so close to the coastline. With that amount of disruption, it almost seems to me that it's, and it's very sad to say that something like this was bound to happen.
Joey, concerned about overdevelopment. Have you heard about that?
That's a conversation that really has been longstanding, honestly, in a place like the city of Miami and South Florida writ large. I mean, I previously covered Miami Beach, and I know that overdevelopment, for a number of reasons, including the threat of sea level rise and honestly, even economic factors, you know, the disruption to the market and the lack of affordable housing have all been the leading talking points when we're talking about overdevelopment in South Florida, right? But this certainly introduces a whole other facet to that issue and raises a lot of questions about to what extent development and overdevelopment, as it is perceived, right, by some people, has anything to do with this. And I think that lends itself a lot to what, you know, Wendy was talking about, right? Like, what happened when that building was built? What went into, you know, the decisions that were made on materials that were used and the foundation and the studies that are going on in that space, that's going to be something that ripples throughout, you know, the development community, the real estate and construction community, just as much as what the insurance ramifications are and what, you know, what's going to happen in the courts after this process. So, or through the rest of this process. So certainly it's a concern, and it'll be another part of the conversation going forward.
And Veronica Zaragovia, you are WLRN's healthcare reporter. While we've just got a couple minutes left here, I did want to ask you, you know, there have been talks about a memorial for the victims at this site, also a sale. So what's the latest on what a memorial could look like or if there's any plans?
Right. Well, that's the discussion that's underway in court. Judge Michael Hansman has said that under no circumstances you want this land to be donated entirely for the use of a memorial or a park. And so he's in the process of getting information from the court-appointed receiver to find out how that land would be appraised. And then he said it's fine if somebody purchased that land at fair market value and then it was decided that people wanted to have a memorial on there alone, that's fine as long as there's money generated to compensate victims. And so it's a very complicated process. We don't know exactly how soon that would be determined and who's going to purchase the land. But I do want to say that Leo Soto, who started the makeshift memorial or the temporary memorial at the tennis court fence on Harding Avenue, has given his all to you know, giving people an opportunity to grieve together there, and he wants to volunteer and help shape a permanent memorial if he can. And I just want to say that I'm grateful for all that he's done for the community.
Thank you. I've been speaking with Veronica Zaragovia, our healthcare reporter for WLRN, and Wendy Rhodes, the senior politics and economy reporter for the Palm Beach Post. And she worked with USA Today on her coverage of Surfside, as well as Joey Fletches, reporter for the Miami Herald. Thank you all three for your time today.
Thank you, Katie.
Thank you.
That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. It's produced by Andrea Perdomo. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. Richard Ives answers our phones. I'm Katie Spitalski-Munoz, in for Tom Hudson. Thank you for calling and listening. This program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.